From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. On today's show, the Autry Museum is selling the historic Southwest Museum property in Mount Washington. And then, Allison Clayman's documentary, The Brink, gives some insight into Steve Bannon's political strategy in the United States and, more recently, in Europe.
He's promising people stuff. He plays politics. He's telling people, things are bad, the elites have done it to you, I have the answers.
And an LA theater company examines our political landscape and challenges playwrights with this question, what matters now? All that coming up on The Frame. The Autry Museum of the American West today announced its plans to sell the Southwest Museum of the American Indian, which was taken over by the Autry in a 2003 merger. The sale of the 12-acre property does not include the museum's vast collection of Native American ceramics, baskets, tapestries, and much, much more. Some 400,000 objects in total. The Autry says it spent some $20 million on renovations and preservation at the Southwest campus. But now it says the museum is too expensive to restore to a level suitable to showcase its priceless collection. The museum's been largely closed to the public for several years. Earlier today, I spoke with the Autry's president and CEO, Richard West, a citizen of the Cheyenne Tribe of Oklahoma. And he began by telling me about the 100-year-plus history of the Southwest and his own personal connection to the place.
It was originally opened in 1907, but that was downtown, or in Los Angeles. It moved to the Highland Park area probably about 7 years after that and opened in 1914. And it is an institution which honestly, almost from the beginning, struggled financially. I think within 20 years, the museum was already facing financial challenges, and it sort of did for the rest of the 20th century, and we're trying to resolve them now in the 21st century. I have a very personal connection simply because I'm Native, and I saw the museum when I was a child, visiting from Oklahoma, where I was growing up, and seeing the collection. And even at age less than 10, I think I was, sort of looking up at those shelves in the Caracol Tower and seeing all of those ceramics basically held on the shelf by wire and realizing that this was an institution in some distress from that point. But it is such a significant collection. As you know, my other history in the museum field is at the National Museum of the American Indian.
Yes.
And this collection is of the very same rank in terms of pure quality.
Now, shifting over to the Autry for a second. So when was the Autry created and what was the intention behind it? What was the mission statement?
Well, the Autry was created and opened in 1988. And it's gone by several different names, but I think that the current name is really the one that is most apt. It's the Autry Museum of the American West. And that fits quite perfectly with our mission statement, which is really to try to tell, to interpret, to represent on a very inclusive basis all the stories of the American West. And honestly, I think that it was the arrival of the Old Southwest Museum collection as an integrated part of the Autry collections that made it much easier for the Autry to live by its mission. And not that it's exclusively a choice between Cowboy America and Native America.
Right.
But certainly, if you have Native America in the picture, you are beginning to operate on a far more inclusive basis.
So today, the Autry Museum formally announced that it's looking for a new owner for the Southwest Museum. Walk us through this, if you could, Mr. West. What happened and how did we get here?
Upon my arrival in 2013, the situation with respect to Mount Washington and Highland Park and the museum was still sort of, it lacked resolution. I made it my goal to try to make sure that we emerge from that and that we did a couple of things. First of all, that we honored our obligations with respect to the collection under the merger agreement to protect and conserve that collection. The second was that we wanted to respect the legacy of the site and what had actually occurred there. We wanted to maintain a community connectivity and then to figure out a way that we could put things together in a manner that allowed for that place to be sustainable.
Now, just to clarify, though, we're talking about a sale that would be the property, the buildings, and so forth, not the collection itself. This would not affect the collection?
No, it does not affect ownership of the collection.
Okay.
But what I would say is we want to be sure that the Autry has a future role here, too. And I think that that's what the local community much prefers, and that is what I prefer. But we very much would like to contemplate programming that does include the presence of collections over there, but is open to a very wide and more flexible agenda in that regard. Remember that Highland Park is probably one of the most artist-rich sections of the city at this point, in terms of contemporary artists that are working in that very locale. We'd like to figure out a way to draw them into it. The Autry, as you may also know, has entered into a very important collaborative agreement with LACMA. I can see opportunities for collaborations with other arts and culture institutions, which could be programmed in a way that they have impact even or expression at that site, as well as here at the Autry in the main campus in Griffith Park. So it is all of those things.
If I understand right, most of the Southwest Museum's collection is now being cared for and housed at a facility in Burbank. Where will the collection ultimately end up, or, you know, do you even know?
Let me point this out. The facility in Burbank is actually constructed in a way that it is much more quasi-public than collections buildings in the past have been. It is now a much more integrated part of our programming here and even our public programming here. I want to be very careful. In fact, I actually discourage my staff and colleagues here from ever referring to that space as a storage area.
Okay.
It is not simply a storage area. And so that is one possibility. But I'm also saying that that collection will be on display here at the Griffith Park campus and may very well in the future be on display in parts at the old Southwest Museum site.
Rick West Jr. is president and CEO of the Autry Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. Mr. West, it was a real pleasure to speak to you again. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on The Frame, a new documentary about Steve Bannon shines a light on his controversial global strategy. This is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. John Horn is away today. Thanks for joining us. For Alison Klayman's first feature documentary, Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, she followed the Chinese dissident artist for 3 years. Her new film, The Brink, focuses on another dissident of sorts, one with a very different, and some say white nationalist worldview, former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon. Klayman spent 13 months with Bannon, beginning after he left the White House in August of 2017 and right on up through the 2018 midterm elections. Taking a verite, fly-on-the-wall kind of approach, free of narration or talking heads, Klayman is there when Bannon forms an organization to raise money and promote what he calls economic nationalism in America. And she's there when he meets with far-right politicians and activists in Europe who are hoping to win seats in upcoming parliamentary elections. When Klayman stopped by the Frame Studios recently to talk with John Horn about The Brink, she had an answer for a question she gets pretty often. Why would I spend 90 minutes with Steve Bannon?
He's someone that was instrumental in getting Trump elected president, and he engages with a lot of the forces that I think for worse are shaping our world. And rather than, you know, I don't know that you need to spend time with him listening to him give his stump speech for 90 minutes, but I think watching him in action is really important. I think that we have to take Bannon very seriously. I'm using we now, but, you know, if you disagree with Bannon and his ilk, I think you need to take them very seriously. But I think that they're beatable. And those two go hand in hand. And the reason that you have to take them seriously is because they're not going to beat themselves. But they are beatable in the sense that there are people, there are alternative policies that are trying to help citizens. We have to talk about real problems in the world, because otherwise this hateful view gets to own, you know, real talk about problems.
Regardless of what people think about Steve Bannon's politics, I think everybody would agree that he is a very good salesman. Mm. And he has figured out a way to tell a story about the thing that he is selling in what I will call very accessible ways. And what he is selling is a brand of racism and Islamophobia. You spent a lot of time with him. What did you notice about the way he ingratiates himself with people who are listening to him? They could be journalists, they could be politicians. What are his tactics?
He's really good at retail politics. He gets the importance of spending time face to face. There's no crowd too big or, frankly, too small. You know, Bannon is also pretty masterful at creating an in-group. Right. It's something that used to really irk me was that he would always talk about the left as the ones who are playing, quote, identity politics and engaging in culture. And he's the one who's talking about, you know, economic nationalism, this term that he's been trying to kind of brand as his own. And in truth, you know, his style of communicating to people really is about creating this shared identity. You know, we had this great victory with Donald Trump and, you know, using a lot of language that sometimes also is speaking on a lot of different levels. I think that brings maybe to a third point. He absolutely engages in, you know, he has no problem using racist, anti-Semitic dog whistles. Frankly, some of the anti-Muslim stuff isn't so much a dog whistle as just like, you know, outright language. And he's trying to shift it all and say it's talking about jobs. Basically what he does, though, he's promising people stuff. He plays politics. He's telling people things are bad. The elites have done it to you. I have the answers. What those answers are in the end really just boil down to a wall and exclusionary xenophobic policies. And he leaves it to everyone to connect the dots that that's what's going to change their lives. But, you know, he's really good at getting people on his side.
What is it like to watch him manipulate journalists? Because he's very clever. He's like a magician. He is, you know, like deflecting you by waving over here when you're supposed to be looking over there. And I'm going to play a clip of his talking with Paul Lewis, who is a very good journalist at The Guardian.
Some of the people you're doing business with here in Europe are, you know, far right, sometimes quite extreme. Sometimes they've got links to...
Like Orban or who?
Like Philippe de Winter, who you had a meeting with in London.
No, he just came. That was a general dinner.
Does it concern you that Philippe de Winter is like commemorated former SS collaborators?
No. That, I said that kind of stuff is not going to be tolerated in the movement. We were very upfront with that, right? So he just came to the dinner. That was a general dinner. We had, you know, a number of people there.
Paul Lewis is asking him about far right leaders who were at a dinner that actually I captured and show in the film earlier. So we're kind of able to do a callback as you watch him squirming and recasting this dinner that was a large meeting of the minds, you know, dinner of what, like 12 people. And he's saying, oh, it was nothing. Oh, and as if he didn't know who any of these people are.
And it's not like this is some random dinner that he's invited to.
No,
he has organized
he
it. And it
dinner.
Is like the creme de la creme of white nationalist leaders throughout Europe.
Yeah.
Fair enough?
Yes. Creme de la creme is a good word because it's a very...
They're all white men.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very white. Although some of them were, you know, it was really a mixture of people who were leaders of their parties and also outcasts of their parties. But again, they're outcasts because they were so extreme. One of the guys, Kent Ekeroth of the Sweden Democrats, had just been kicked off of the rolls of his party because he was too extreme in his anti-immigrant policies. So anyway, this is the kind of people that are sitting at this dinner, and they're meeting to talk about how they can strategize so that they can win as a unified bloc and change the shape of not just their countries, but Europe as a whole. And I think that, you know, listening to how Bannon is dealing with Paul's very direct and in his very well-prepared questioning, you see how he lies. You see how he really just doesn't enter the conversation in good faith.
We're talking with Allison Clayman about her film, The Brink. I want to play another clip from the film. This is about something called CORE, that stands for
Citizens of the American Republic. It's the 501c4 that Bannon started up right when he left the White House so that he could, you know, engage in American politics with dark money.
Let's listen to this part from the film.
What is the status of your C4 right now?
I just need to know that we're not breaking any laws.
That's number one, the legal stuff. Number two is, at the very least, you just need to have, you have to have a homepage.
I've got that.
They can enter in
They've
an email address.
They've got their email address.
Coming soon.
Everything. And I've got a logo done.
You would be announcing.
Is Citizens for America a good title?
Yeah. Citizens for America?
Citizens for America. Why not?
Sounds like Citizens United.
Yeah, but hold on. Firstly, this movement is all about citizens, right? You can do, you know, it's organizing for America. Then you can do Truckers for America and Women for America and all this stuff. You can play off all the little groups.
So it's basically a few weeks, really, like about 2 months after he's left the White House. This is early November 2017. And he's with Andy Sarabian, who's a Republican strategist. I think right now he's working for Donald Trump Jr., but he had worked closely with Bannon also in the White House. And Raheem Kassam, who's one of the founding editors of Breitbart London. He used to be the chief of staff of Nigel Farage, one of the top pro-Brexit campaigners in the UK. And to me, this scene plays very humorously. Now I'm just talking kind of filmmaking-wise. It was one of the early things that I shot, and I started to see an inspiration for the film in the television series Veep, because I think it's also looking at a bunch of people who have a big vision of what they can do, and they maybe are a little less than perfectly either skilled or organized and to do it. So this is the way that they're trying to like come up with names for their 501c4. And I think you also can see, you know, they're kind of like the little chattering voices, and he's like the one laying it down. How about this? And there's a long pause before anyone wants to tell them what they really think.
How do you make sure as a filmmaker that you have these moments of semi-levity, but these people are talking about what a lot of people would say are very dangerous ideas, and they're affiliated with some very dangerous groups like Golden Dawn, Brothers of Italy. These are anti-immigrant, Islamophobic groups.
I think that's such a good point. And so I should also add, when I first started to think this can be like Veep, but the end of it was, but you're not laughing at the end. And that was really the guiding, one of the guiding sort of ideas, because I also think real life is funny. And the truth is, you know, I think if Bannon, for example, wasn't someone who also charms people and kind of works the media, and some of his political capital, interpersonal capital comes from being able to crack jokes. He makes self-deprecating jokes. A lot of the jokes in the movie are him making fun of himself. And I think that, I put it in and some people are like, wow, I didn't realize that he was actually someone who seemed like fun to hang out with. So far, no one I know who has seen the films says that and then says, and so you know what? He really convinced me, you know, and now I changed my mind. I mean, I think that we have to be willing to see the people who are doing, you know, without mincing words, doing what you just said, spreading hate, who are willing to not only promote policies that harm people, but to use rhetoric that inspires others to violence. We can call that out. But we have to recognize that they're people too, because otherwise we might not notice someone like that in our midst.
Allison Clayman is the director of The Brink. Allison, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The Brink opens in select theaters this Friday. Coming up on The Frame, an LA theater company surveyed the political landscape and asked playwrights to address this question: what matters now? The LA-based Open Fist Theater Company is trying to make sense of our country's political landscape. It's currently presenting a pop-up festival to showcase short plays with political themes. The playwrights, who come from all over America, are trying to answer a question: what matters now? The Frame contributor, Marcos Najera, has our story.
Take a look here. If Donald Trump wins tonight, no matter who they voted for...
In the wake of the last presidential election, the actors, directors, and writers in the Open Fist Theater Company were a bit stumped.
Anderson, this night is turning out to be a real nail-biter.
All along, the Trump campaign has been saying that Florida's a must-win for them.
They were also plenty angry.
It's time to listen to us in Michigan and Wisconsin and work for the people.
Hillary Clinton has called Donald Trump to concede the race.
So, who better to turn to than the Bard?
Please bow me with your hands, peace, sit you down, and let me wring your heart, for so I shall, if it be made of penetrable stuff.
When you want to express rage at country, castle, and king.
The counterfeit presentment of two brothers.
Two large portraits flank Open Fist actor Lane Allison at center stage.
The front of Jove himself.
There's Barack Obama on one side.
A combination and form indeed, where every god did seem to set his seal to give the world assurance of a man.
And Donald Trump on the other.
This is your husband. Like a mildewed ear blasting his wholesome brother. Have you eyes? Could you on this fair mountain leave to feed and batten on this moor? Have you eyes?
She takes turns hurling verbatim lines from Hamlet at the two men.
You cannot call it love. For at your age, the heyday in the blood is tame. It's humble and waits upon the judgment. And what judgment?
Out in the audience, we laugh a lot, groan occasionally, and curl up in the comfy sofas. Luckily, there's a bar right inside the theater if you want a drink before, during, or even after the show. This is the third year of Open Fist's annual Political Theater Fest. When you walk inside one of the spaces at the Atwater Village Theater Complex, you're welcomed by a fun, Silver Lake hipster version of the Moulin Rouge, complete with small red fringe lamps, mismatched furniture, and lots of red wine.
We're doing a little post-show reception right here in the middle of the stage. The bar is open.
They've created a speakeasy of sorts, says company member Amanda Wire, because we live in a time where talking about politics is anything but easy.
Back in the day in Chicago, which is where I started doing all of, you know, the theater thing, we'd all go to bars afterward and talk about the shows we just saw. In L.A., I think people worry about parking and the cars and the how do we get to the whatever. So we're like, if we bring that atmosphere here, and especially because there seems to be just a lot of charged emotion and what do we do now, I personally, you know, that's the shared communal experience that I think sometimes we're missing.
On any given weekend night, the festival lineup features a rotating roster of short plays that tackle political topics, from the tame to the taboo.
You guys are never going to believe this, but Zach's back!
What? Who said?
I saw him!
Amanda Wire wrote and directed a piece called Heart Attack Zach.
Jill had an agenda, so...
Jill's agenda was to not get date-raped and left for dead in some random family's backyard.
My kind of overall theme that I wanted to explore was women, where we choose to have another woman's back.
Hardly ever. Hashtag OKCupid is so stupid!
Wire's play tells the story of a young woman who reconnects with her college crush, only to discover he's been accused of abusing women. But she and her friends aren't quite sure who or what to believe.
The Zach I knew in college would never, ever do that. Whereas Jill...
What? Whereas Jill what?
She was just known to come into the bar where I work a lot. Like, a lot.
And that has what to do with what?
It's something that I think a lot of us have found ourselves having to take sides on, because I want Al Franken back.
The former U.S. senator from Minnesota resigned after a photograph surfaced of him pretending to fondle a sleeping woman.
I think what happened there, I'm like, that looks like sketch tours that I did back in college where people are playing jokes, and then it sucks that there's a photo of that, but it's the photo still looked staged and like it was a joke and like she was in on it. Well, who's it for me to say? It's for her to say. And okay. But then when Kavanaugh came up, I'm like, this poor woman who's having to go up and testify, whose family's getting death threats, and he's still on the Supreme Court.
It's not an easy conversation to have, admits Wire, but she says that's exactly the point of this festival.
You can kind of look across the space at another audience member and sort of see them reacting and reflecting, and you realize, okay, we're all in this together, and afterward we're going to, you know, the politics might not be comfortable right now, but the couches are.
Ow. Kiss me.
Ow.
The Protest is a play written by James William Evans, inspired by his time as a grad student some 20 years ago in New York.
And the things I was protesting against in 2002 now seem kind of quaint.
Back then, Evans was protesting the war in Iraq, so he wrote this play to chronicle his frustrations and feelings.
Swim a lot, avoid the hot.
What are you doing?
Two actors play penguins locked in a glass display case. They spend their days smiling at tourists and banging their heads against the wall, hoping for better days.
What these penguins are going through in terms of like banging their heads up against the wall, you know, we're dealing with that like on a day-to-day basis.
Show director, Derek Manson.
There's some reassurance that's happening. You know, this one character's trying to reassure this other character. I know you feel dizzy. I know everything is chaos. You've been banging your head, but you gotta stick with it. You gotta keep fighting the fight.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
What Matters Now is at the Atwater Village Theater in LA through April 13th. And that's The Frame for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Stephen Cuevas. See you tomorrow.